Thank you, Aaron. Well, good evening, everybody, and I just want to say on behalf of Wells Fargo Bank, very pleased to be here tonight and to introduce an icon, I think many of us think that, of the local food scene, and a rising star American chef, Thomas McNaughton. At Wells Fargo, we celebrate and support the work of small businesses, especially those who build up our communities, contribute to our city's culture as well as our good health, and Chef McNaughton does that as well. With his passion for supporting local farmers and producers, I should say, and a commitment to serving the appetites and souls of us San Franciscans. So for these reasons and more, Wells Fargo is excited to support the Commonwealth Club by sponsoring tonight's program and Chef Thomas McNaughton and our moderator, Adam Savage, who many of you know from Mythbusters. So please help me give them a warm welcome.
So just 5 short years ago, Thomas McNaughton, chef and partner at Natimius, jump-started his solo cooking career with a $500 stove and a dream. Now he is an American icon with 4 James Beard Award nominations under his belt, 3 of the top eateries in the city, Flour and Water, Central Kitchen, and Salumeria, and a cult-like following for his pasta. With a devotion to seasonality, local agriculture, and community, his creative combinations have blown diners and critics away, and tonight we're here to celebrate his latest accomplishment, Flour and Water Pasta, which gives a behind-the-scenes tour of Thomas's world. I'm Adam Savage, host of Mythbusters on Discovery, on some evening, which they won't tell me. welcome. Thomas, first of all, congratulations on the book. It's beautiful.
Thank you.
It's really, really lovely. Is it something completely new after opening 3 restaurants to try and put some of that onto the page?
Yeah, I think that the Flour and Water, the cookbook, took 2.5 years to make. And at the end of it, you kind of forget, or at least for me, I kind of forgot where we began and how we ended up. And was it good? Was it terrible? Is it the worst book ever written, or is it the best book ever written? And I think that the reason why I'm doing what I'm doing is for a learning experience, and if anything is a new learning experience, it's a completely different side of the industry, and that's the publishing, and so huge learning experience.
So when you start to take a look at recipes and crowd favorites from the restaurant,
right?
I mean, engineering a dish for 300 meals a night is very different than putting it onto a single page.
Yeah.
Did you start to, what was your process of problem solving that?
Cara Bratcher, our CFO, is in the audience, and she'll probably cringe when I say this. The way that we run the Flour and Water kitchen is the worst business plan ever, because it's a terrible, you can start with a case of the same vegetable, a case of tenderloins, and put it together. And for most chefs, they say, I want to create a dish, and I need to order pork tenderloin, I need to order asparagus, I need to order eggs for a hollandaise sauce, and then you put that together. And you can do the math on a piece of paper, the tenderloins are going to cost this. And we really start in the completely opposite mindset. We say, we want this dish to be based around onions. Depending on what farm we order the onions from, there's something completely different, and all of our dishes just evolve. And there's very little recipe. And there's very little recipe books that we actually cook out of in the restaurant. We just look at the food and we adapt. You know, we have really young spring onions, and they're quite small. We can roast them in the wood oven and garnish the dish with maybe just a little bit of sweet vinegar. The next day they come in from a completely different farm, and they're really bulbous, and we puree them and we put that down on the plate. And so approaching a cookbook from not having any recipes to really go off of was incredibly difficult. And then obviously cooking 200 meals and cooking a dish for 4 people that can be replicated in a home kitchen is, it's 2 different worlds. It's literally 2 different mentalities, and certainly wasn't my background. And so we had a lot of a great help from our recipe tester, Travis Ray, who's one of the food developers for Williams-Sonoma. And we would bicker for hours and hours and hours, because I wanted one more pan, and they need a 14-inch stock pot, and they need a 100-gallon stock pot to do this, and a circulator, and a smoker, and whittling that down to the true essence of what a great dish is, I think was a learning experience in itself, and then also just a different perspective to come about it.
Does that come through in the restaurant then? Does it come full circle and inform or change the way you think about serving a dish?
Well, I think hindsight's always 20/20. If we were ever to write a cookbook again, I don't think it would take 2.5 years. I think that we kind of shorten that length of time, and certainly, I mean, documentation is a huge part of the process, and there's people that will come to us and say, we went to Fire and Water 4 years ago, we had this amazing dish, and had this and this, and we're scratching our heads saying, well, really, was that at Fire and Water? Or, you know, and so that the part of documentation was a huge light bulb that went off in our head and saying, we're capturing these, not only ratios, recipes, but ideas, and being able to bring them back.
You know? Now, am I correct? Do you still live above Flour and Water?
Unfortunately or fortunately, we're not sure what it is, but I still live above Flour and Water.
And that's next to the test kitchen.
Right.
So it sounds like there's almost never a period of time when you're not actually working as long as your eyes are open.
Yeah, I mean, well, you have to walk through the dough room to get to my house, and so, you know, sometimes I walk with blinders on and try to run as fast as I can, or it's always you get 3 steps and you go 3 steps behind and say, you know, what the hell's going on over there? But yeah, there's never a dull moment. Our kitchen, by the time we end service, we scrub down the entire kitchen. It's probably closed for about an hour. And then we start the entire morning process all over again. So
I have this image in my head of a test kitchen of a chef, like 5 different pots boiling and trying from each one, and then finally going, ah, that's perfect. How close to reality is that?
I would love to see a kitchen that the Mythbusters put together, or a test kitchen that the Mythbusters put together. That'd be pretty interesting, right? No, it's something that it started with the cookbook. We had this office space. We wanted to utilize it in some way to help the fairy tiny kitchen downstairs, and it was to help document, to test, and to retest all the recipes in the cookbook. We have a library there for all the cooks to check out books, and we have a big one of the walls is covered in chalk paint. It's really just like an educational center, you know, that we're constantly developing or redeveloping.
You know, you said it's a different world, making a recipe versus a service for hundreds of people. It occurs to me, you got your start at 14, mm-hmm. 15, cooking in country clubs, yes?
First it started with washing the pans.
Right.
Cooking, you know?
But then you were serving hundreds of people food before you ever cooked for yourself at the end of the day.
Right, yeah. And I think it's different. The dynamic of a kitchen, the dynamic of a professional kitchen is very different than making a great meal at home. And there's so many facets to it. There's so many facets to running a restaurant, the daily operations. Cooking an amazing plate of pasta is just one very small aspect of running a great restaurant, or hopefully a great restaurant.
Yeah. And when you were 14, 15 working in the country clubs, what was the tipping point that helped you, that made you decide, this is where I belong?
I think it was the dynamic of how a kitchen's ran. I mean, it was a combination of two things. It was working with hands, whether that was, you know, creating a dish or being able to manipulate something and be proud of, having a task in front of you and actually to utilize your hands to create something. I think that's a huge aspect of it. But then it's the dynamic. I mean, there's titles that get thrown around, a chef, a master chef, you know, conquering the food world, all that's an impossible thing to obtain. You never quite stop learning inside of a kitchen. That's something that just fascinated me. I was always the kid that picked up way too many hobbies. It was like the jack of all trades, master of none. And just to really understand them and try to get behind them and see how something works, that never stops in a kitchen. Never stops in a restaurant, whether you're in the front of the house or the back of the house. And the dynamic of always being able to learn something, whether that's a skill, task, knowledge, it was always fascinating to me.
You know, jack of all trades, master of none is only half of the phrase. The second half is, though often better than a master of one.
I always miss that one, I guess.
As a generalist, I'm correcting everybody about that. So starting in country club cooking and then going to culinary school, we think of country club cooking as not great cooking.
Sure.
But was there anything that you took from that world that still holds as like, this is how you should do something, mm-hmm. or this was the right way to learn this?
The first country club, this is a terrible story, and I probably shouldn't tell it. The first country club that I started at, I remember the day that the chef came back in the kitchen, and he looked really upset, and he just got done talking to the general manager, and he came back behind the line. The line is where, you know, all the food's prepared in front of hot stoves. They call it the line. And I remember he came back and looked really disgruntled, and he brought all the cooks around, and he says, "All right, guys, they said we can't smoke cigarettes behind the line anymore." And country clubs, you know, one step away, that has the notoriety of being one step ahead of a hospital food. But why I loved it and why, I mean, which is so, what was so important to me is the basics, timing. Being a short, the best cook in the world starts as a short order cook. It's not the 19-year-old that wants to go to culinary school and buys that circulator right out of culinary school. And it's really starting at the basics and timing. Understanding the logistics of just frying an egg. And you hear all these top chefs, you know, say, well, if you know how to roast a chicken, then that's how you're a true test. But there's something very, very true of that. If you understand the basic, and then you can build on that, it's the understanding the foundations. It's like we say at the restaurant all the time, if we understand where an ingredient comes from, we can then better utilize it. If we make vinegar, it's not because we're going to make the best vinegar in the world. We're just going to understand the logistics of making vinegar. And then when we season a dish, we understand it a little bit more. And that's what working at a country club was to me, was the foundation of the fundamentals of cooking. It's reading a ticket for the first time, being under pressure, having nine things to do at the same time. And that's what was so important to me. Mm-hmm. You know, I love to see that on resumes, someone that's a short order cook. Even, you know, coming from at the very, very beginning of a resume, you know, they worked at Burger King. Well, they understand it, timing and logistics, and then they built their way up and, you know, seeing a resume that they spent the last 4 months at Noma and that was really it. Well, that's an amazing restaurant, but you just picked herbs in the corner. You know, you didn't really take that much from that experience. And starting at the very, very beginning and understanding a foundation, that's what the most important thing was to me.
Is there an early disaster of you losing control of all the different timings in the kitchen?
I've told this story way too many times. It was when I first moved to the city, and that was, you know, the big city lights. Moving out from South Jersey, and I actually left cooking school because I had a job opportunity from Roland Passeau at La Folie. It's a very, very classic French restaurant. I was still in the mindset I wanted that strong French, you know, background. And he was still in the kitchen screaming every single night. Very, very tiny kitchen. And one of the basic experiences that I had there, being a line cook, was we had a frog leg soup on the menu, which was white, garlic base, which is white, and a garlic puree, that's white. It was Saturday night, we're closed on Sundays, and there's an extern, they always do the grunt work, and I said, go in the walk-in, which is the big refrigerator, downsize everything, which means it's such a tiny space, you have to downsize. If you take a cup out, downsize it to a different container. And come Monday at 5:30, I knew that I had garlic base, garlic puree, and frog leg soup in the walk-in. Don't even worry about it. I didn't even see it. I didn't go through my clipboard and you know, dot all the I's and cross all the T's. And at 5:30, I realized that the extern combined all the ingredients into one giant vat. And I'm sure people in this crowd have eaten at La Folie. And I'm sure people in this crowd, while eating at La Folie, has heard Roland scream from the kitchen. And it was just one of those foundations that I know, like, and I try to instill in so many cooks today, is that every single day you're starting fresh, and it doesn't matter if you saw it last night. And just one little thing that that was a huge impression. Obviously, and there's skills and learning lessons that happen every single day like that in the kitchen. So.
Well, now as a restaurateur, now you're hiring people, and I know that San Francisco, there's something like 27 restaurants opening in the next couple of months, which makes it harder to find people.
Right.
Are you starting people with smaller resumes and trying to shape them?
I think when Flour and Water opened, I mean, we had a waiting list of cooks. It didn't matter. It was, we could hire the best cooks we possibly can. We had a waiting list, 5 or 6 or 10. And the mentality shifted. I mean, the saturation of the economy in San Francisco is amazing. You know, there's 27 restaurants that are opening. Obviously, there's money to open up these places. which is great, but the labor pool, you know, starts to dry up. And I think that the mentality that we had as a company, two things, as a company that is looking for cooks, but also a company that's growing, you know. We'll have upwards of 200 employees in 6 months versus having 30 employees when we started. The mentality shifts to how come there's not any good cooks out there to how do we train cooks, you know. I get so sick of hearing chefs saying, well, there's no good cooks out of there, and all these cooks coming from culinary school, they're terrible. Well, it's my responsibility to train them. I'm a part of the industry, and it's to set up a system where we're training people from the ground up, and not just expecting a talented and qualified individual to come to us. And I think that's, I always say that if restaurants paid a line cook what they deserve to get paid, none of us could afford to eat at restaurants, right? Because the $30 entree would turn to a $60 entree. So the pay is terrible. The hours are long. You're around hot things. You're hurting yourself all day long. Roland's constantly screaming at you, you know. Those line cooks aren't there just to get paid, you know. And so it's up to us to decide, you know, in which manner we're paying them. And a lot of that is education.
Now, you talked about Roland yelling, and that's a lot of people's image of the kitchen, mm-hmm. is that there's somebody.
I'm afraid he's going to come out
yelling and screaming.
I heard us talking about him.
How do you run your kitchen? Is there a lot of yelling?
No, not at all. But we do. It's funny because we run a kitchen that's strict in a way that we have to get our work done. But we invest so much time in, you know, what are the needs of the cook? And part of a great atmosphere is part of the needs, you know. When you cook out of fear, you're constantly hiding something. If somebody's screaming, Roland is one of the most amazing individuals, by the way. I could call him right now and he'd be here in a heartbeat to help out in any type of way. But, you know, when you cook out of fear, you're hiding something constantly. You burn something a little bit. That's fine. Can't tell him. You know, when it's an open environment, we cook. I'm responsible for the menu that goes on print at Flour and Water Central Kitchen in Saloon Maria, but I'm not responsible for the menu. I mean, it's a completely collaborative nature, and we're trying to constantly push each other. And I can go up to the test kitchen and I can surround myself by books, and I'll be there for 2 hours just, you know, playing the drums and, you know, looking at SF Eater online, you know, the Chronicle Inside Scoop. And when we have a bunch of cooks up there, it's a synergy, and I think that's a part of it. I think that's very, very important to us that we run our kitchens that way, that we're constantly trying to push people to be a part of the dialogue. And that, for me, is the foundation of their education. They're constantly pushing for them to think, you know.
And to be a part of the conversation.
I mean, if I just scream and I say, do it this way, this is the way it's going to be done, I mean, they turn around, they roll their eyes, and they're like, I'm frying the egg. But if I go to them and I say, you know, I'm thinking of an egg component on this dish, what are you thinking? They go home, they're shampooing their hair, they're still thinking about their egg. And then when they come to work the next day, there's so much of themselves on that plate. Now, I have to funnel it down. I have to make it work for Flour and Water and make it work for 200 people. But every single time they put up a plate, they're like, well, I have something of myself on this plate.
Yeah.
They're going to make that plate the best possible food it can be. It's not them just turning around and rolling their eyes.
Now, I want to circle back to something you said at the beginning, which is, you know, we may use onions, and it depends on what farm those onions come from. And frankly, we cook a bunch in my house.
Right.
But I have no idea what to look for in onions from different farms.
Sure.
Can you give a little crash course in what you'd taste for in onions, depending on where they're from?
It's just like, it depends what you want to do with it, right? You know, if you're looking to just saute down onions, just grab a giant cured onion, you know? And that cured onion means it's from last season. When you see like a fresh spring onion with a green top on it, that's fresh from the ground. The onion that you buy that's yellow or white on the outside, that's last season. It means it's completely cured. So it really just depends what you're going to do with it. Yeah. Is that, did I dance around it enough?
I'll let that one go.
Yeah, okay.
So after cooking in France and Germany and Italy, did you moving between all those different countries with vastly different cuisines,
right?
Were you looking for something specific?
No, not at all. The I think obviously with this cookbook, I'm going to get pigeonholed as the pasta guy. No, not at all. I mean, it's something where traveling is more in kitchens. A lot of young chefs think that they have to travel. They have to go abroad and see different kitchens. And really, it's equal parts learning how to cook, learning larger and different operations. Every single kitchen is set up completely different, but it's also a life experience as well. It's, you know, and I've always said that in foreign kitchens, there's a common language with food. You can see the guy that just came out of the walk-in and all of his mise en place was put together in one bin and the look of fear and he needs help. And you can see the guy that's behind, and you can, if you learn how to turn an artichoke and someone's turning artichokes, just belly up to him. There's a common food language that goes on. And so language barrier was never a problem inside of a kitchen. But it's part life experience, and it's also part seeing different cultures. I mean, food and culture kind of go hand in hand depending on what country you're in and, you know, what style of restaurant you're in. And so, I mean, culture was a huge part of it. And there's just so many different layers or dynamics to it that it's not just about learning how to cook.
Well, and the biographies that are out there about you talk about you getting trained in the French method, mm-hmm. and then falling in love with pasta.
Sure.
So is there a way in which, how does the French method work into your pasta, work into your Italian cuisine? Or do you not even think of it as Italian?
Yeah, it's like, well, I struggle with a lot of people that just have one restaurant, or say a very high-end restaurant, they start to have a voice in their own food. It's funny to see a young cook transition to just repetition to then having a voice in their own food, saying, hey, I want to experiment with this, or I like the combination of this. Flour and water is an Italian, but we say it's a regional Italian restaurant without turning our backs on California ingredients. You're not going to see that many avocados in Italy, but we're in Northern California. We're in the home, you know, this is where avocados grow, so we're going to treat it in an Italian sensibility of simplicity. You know, we're not going to hide that avocado and have it be a sphere and it comes down. There's smoke that comes from the bottom of it. It's treat it simply, and that's what it is. It's just an avocado. And so French background is really about repetition, and it's about meticulous standards of mise en place. And I think that that was a huge part of it. Flour and water, I guess, just like, you know, being a child and interested in so many hobbies, it was one thing. It was really just, we started to center it just around pasta. And how can we perfect this? We need a dough room. Let's build a dough room. Let's build a room that's only about our bread making and our, you know, and our pasta production. And then just diving into it, we begged Harold McGee to come and have lunches with us just for the cookbook. And it was all these things that, how do we really get to the bottom? We think we're doing this. We've heard this, you know. But what really happens with those proteins when we, you know, introduce them to, you know, whatever it is, whether that's, you know, what happens with egg whites when we introduce it to a wheat product? You know, and it's just diving into it and immersing completely onto it to hopefully, just like making the vinegar, kind of understand the product a little bit more.
What would you think that most Americans or most people don't know about pasta that you'd love them to understand?
I always say that I was culinary abused as a child. And one thing that my mother used to do in South Jersey was boil pasta. She would take it out of the water and coat it in olive oil. And then she would take, Prego sauce out of the can. And she and Roland are going to pop out somewhere. And pour it over the pasta. There is a synergy with pasta and its sauce, you know. We do a lot of pasta classes, and really our pasta classes are just about the dough and manipulating the dough and how they work with fillings or whatever it is. And people beg us to do sauce classes, and we really can't because they're so complicated, meaning that it's just so much to talk about and to break it down and how we would put it together. But the marriage of sauce and pasta, and we touch about it in the cookbook. And I was lying to cooks for years and years. And until we sat down with Harold McGee a couple of times, I was talking about, you know, telling the terrible story of my mother putting olive oil on. That creates a barrier. Literally, the oil is a lubricant, and it's a barrier on the outside of the pasta that doesn't allow that sauce to actually even touch the noodle in most cases, right? So, and I'm not judging anybody here that's doing that at home. Just buy the book.
We're judging your mother.
Just buy the book, read it from cover to cover, you'll get it. I was saying the whole time that this, you know, we're creating this strand of pasta, and we're cooking it 80% of the time in the water and 20% of the time in the sauce itself. And that noodle's literally absorbing flavor. It's absorbing all the flavor that goes in these sauces. It's completely wrong. What's happening is that all those products can't actually absorb those flavors. It's a scientific term called, not absorption with a B, it's adsorption. Right? Meaning that all those flavors, that pasta's literally just separating out the water and it's absorbing all the water molecules. All those flavorings, all like the essential oils that are going on from those flavors are actually creating a barrier on the outside. So I was right in the sense of that it's creating, it's clinging together, but I thought it was absorbing all of them. And it's the how the noodles like weeps out a little bit of starch that helps the consistency of your sauce. But it's creating a film. So if you take that spaghetti and you put a layer of olive oil on the outside of it, there is zero adsorption going on, right? It's not able to cling to that noodle. And I think that's one of the most important things.
Cool.
Long-winded answers come out of this guy.
I'm thinking about lots of plates of pasta we've cooked in our house. If you had one piece of advice for people of how they're screwing up their pasta.
Oh, man, I should have saved that answer. You know? if you're making fresh pasta, you see all these terrible photographs, and I'm so whenever I see pasta, I'm always like looking at the photographs and how the noodles look and stuff like that. If you're making fresh pasta, the worst thing you can do in the world, and this is a total myth, to roll out pasta, to cut it and put it directly into water. It's fresh pasta. It's incredibly, incredibly fresh. There has to be a dehydrating phase. You want your noodles to be like leather, right? What happens when you roll out pasta and say you're cutting pappardelle? We all know pappardelle and love it. If we cut pappardelle and we touch that noodle is so incredibly soft that it'll warp and it'll pull and it'll bend. So the consistency of that noodle is something completely different. Where it pulled a little bit, it's going to cook a lot faster. Where it warped and it'll bend, what you really want to do is when you're rolling out fresh pasta, add semolina in layers and let the pasta dehydrate a little bit to the point where it's still pliable, but we want to treat it like leather. And so when we pull it and we cut it with a knife, it's completely sharp edges. And that pasta is one consistency. It's one width all the way through. It won't warp or pull. You know?
Awesome. That's exactly what I was hoping to hear.
Cool. Sweating a little less.
How often these days are you surprised by food?
Every day. I think that, like I say, you never stop learning. You know, I go to restaurants for continuing education. You know, I go to restaurants to see something, and that's maybe a plate of food. It's like you're picking up the china, like, where the hell do they get this? This is amazing, you know? But every day, yeah, and I really believe that. I think that if you're not, we're really lucky in the Bay Area to have a collaborative, not only just the food, but a collaborative of chefs that are willing to teach and to learn and to kind of push each other. We're very much lucky to have that. And I think if you don't have a humble nature about kitchens, you're really just cutting yourself off to all this amazing repertoire that kind of goes on around you. It's just like, to me, that's like saying, "Well, I never want to look at a cookbook ever. I'm never going to look at a cookbook." I think it's the same thing. It's the more that I go out to eat and I see food, or we were talking about Bar Tartine before we went on here about all the amazing things that they have in the kitchen. I mean, like, I go back there and you get chef envy, you know, you're literally like, oh God, you're doing that. You're doing, well, how come we're not doing this? Where the hell did you get that china from? You know? And so I think every day. Yeah, definitely.
Well, and so when Flower and Water first opened, you became very well known very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And over the course
all smoke and mirrors, you know?
But it involves a bunch of other skills,
right?
And it's not just cooking a meal. It's not just running a kitchen. There's also an enterprise, and there's a mythos, and then there's other restaurants. Would there be something in those? I mean, so clearly you like picking up other skill sets as well. Mm-hmm. Is there something within the success that you guys have enjoyed over the past 5 years where you've learned a skill you never expected you would get good at?
Oh, man.
While you're thinking of that, I have another one.
No, I can do it.
Okay.
on a side note, within Fire and Water has been open for about 5.5 years. I literally just got a desk in the office, and it's carved out of a little corner in our events team office. Kate Michael's in the crowd, and I had to tape off. I had to tape off my office, and nobody was allowed to go in there. So office skills are not one of them. Filing, you know, filling out paperwork. I love the dynamic of personalities, and I think that there is and we've seen many amazing managers come through that are amazing cooks, and they're terrible managers. You can be an amazing cook. You can put that plate of food. You know, you can cook the line, and you can do 500 covers tonight and have zero problem. It's the cleanest station in the world, and the food comes up. It's seasoned perfectly, and it comes in a timely manner. Being a cook is one thing. Being a manager is something completely different. And I've seen amazing cooks turn out to be terrible managers. And that's a skill set all on its own.
Yeah.
And I think one thing that I'm talented at is on the ground floor of managing. Well, and that means, you know, having 30 employees and being in front of them the entire time and pushing them and motivating them and being the one with the good spirit that can pick up a knife and, you know, work a little bit harder than them sometimes. And at least I thought. And, you know, I'm going through a different phase of my career right now where, not to say that I think I'm failing at it, but it's a completely different realm of not being a manager on the floor, but it's all of a sudden being a manager that's overarching, that's not able to motivate on the ground. It's being able to motivate from the top. And so that's a new skill set to me that I think I'm trying to take on. Maybe a little too quickly.
Well, when you get famous, one of the cool things is you get to meet a lot of your heroes.
Sure.
So you have an experience of being sort of blown away by.
I do not think I'm famous, and I do not think I forget the word that was used in the introduction. A culinary icon. I don't know if I'm there yet. You know, I think even more so with technology, the world becomes a very, very small and very quick, fast-paced place. You don't even need the library and the test kitchen. You Google online how to make a souffle, you're going to make a great souffle. Look at a couple of websites. And so you look at Twitter and Facebook and all these things that all of a sudden the communication happens so much faster with, you know, which I appear as idols. I hung out with having a blank here last night at Quesa Sunday Suppers. Jacques Pepin. I hung out with Jacques Pepin last night. I mean, obviously, a culinary icon. That's a culinary icon.
Yeah.
I mean, it was hysterical. So I'm talking to them, and there's all these cameras coming over, and they're snapping pictures, and I'm talking to him for a while. And he walked away, and one of our young cooks that we brought came up to me and said, "Who's that old guy you were talking to?" And I was like, "Oh, my God." But, yeah, certainly. We cooked for Jacques Pepin last night at Sunday Suppers, and we spit roasted a pig and had the head on the spit roast, and he just quietly came over and he said, "Can I get the brains and the jowl?" I mean, something like that is like, Jacques Pepin's asking for the jowls, you give him the jowls, you know? But yeah, I mean, that's obviously something that's most of the experiences are humbling, you know, having these people in front of you or having access to them, whether that's like in person, being able to feed them the jowl, or on Twitter where like somebody, it's like, sometimes I lost my password for 6 months and I just got it back the last couple of days. So I'm back. I'm back. And I'm sorry I didn't respond to you if you said something. But seeing somebody follow you, being chefs around the world, not only the nation, but all of a sudden you get like a follow for somebody like a chef idol that I have in Spain. It's like, well, he's following? What the hell do I have to say, you know? So.
I read that you like history and historical recipes.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So can you talk a little bit about where you'll find those and how you'll unpack old languages and old recipes to find something new?
I would start at Omnivore Books, you know, and I just feel like the basis of, it goes back to stuff that we've talked about on this panel about, you know, the foundation of cultures. I mean, it really starts with cultures for me. And it's the culture that goes behind the food feeds those recipes, right? You know, if your culture doesn't allow you to eat pork, you're not going to have a recipe about pork. And so the culture really kind of fuels what those recipes are. And I love like old cooking techniques. And, you know, there's fads that come and go right now. It's all about hearths and cooking on wood fire. But this is amazing, amazing. I am terrible at, I'm terrible at cookbooks. If I get a cookbook, it's 90% for the photos. You know, I'm just kind of flipping through the photos and getting inspiration from that, seeing a dish, and whether that's like a color palette for the dish or, you know, that dish is based off of onions, and all of a sudden we create a similar dish, but it's really not similar at all because it's based off of eggplant. And, you know, I love or need a jumping point. And so history has so much to do with that jumping point to say, you know, oysters Rockefeller. That's really it. Well, the ingredients are these basic five ingredients. And then how do we want to interpret that? It's not really finding an old oyster Rockefeller recipe and replicating it. It's saying, how do we want to make this our own? And I think that's always something that has made Flour and Water very special, is that we just didn't want to replicate. We replicate a margarita pizza, and that's about it, you know? That's the only dish that we really replicate. It's always putting our own little twist in it, and part of that's cooking selfishly, you know?
And in some of the old recipes or looking through old texts, have you come across, has it happened that you've come across a juxtaposition of tastes that had never occurred to you?
I mean, obviously, with we're reopening Café du Nord in Upper Market. And just looking to old, Café du Nord was opened in 1907. It's operated since 1907. That means that it was an operating bar through Prohibition, and it has spanned the test of time. And looking at recipes back then, obviously how if you look at recipes in 1907, we all look at like typical San Francisco menus. In the height of summer, you're going to see blistered padrones, you know, with sea salt and lemon. You know, there's certain dishes that you're going to see all across all these menus in San Francisco. It was funny in 1907, you know, through whatever era it was, all of those, there were still fads back then. And you would see them on different menus, and they kind of carried throughout. And if you looked at menus in 1907 or you looked at menus in 1925, there was this, or 1935, all through those years, there was still something that kind of ran through a lot of menus. And So
within the San Francisco restaurant community, there is always the phrase, California cuisine.
Uh-huh.
And it's this behemoth of a phrase.
Sure.
Do you have a way that you define it in your head? What defines California?
Yeah, well, I don't think it's a myth. I think it certainly exists out there. When I travel, I start to crave Bay Area food. And I think what's the biggest common denominator is freshness to it. There's a lightness to it. There's an acidity to it. It's certainly, I mean, obviously another fad that's going vegetable driven, you know. But there's certainly a sense of lightness and freshness to it. And it's certainly treating ingredients with integrity. And, you know, how many restaurants in San Francisco have heavy, you know, Mornay sauces and super heavy reductions? If you go to New Orleans right now, you know, obviously there's a different style of food there. So I think definitely the world California cuisine has been abused at times. But I think at the forefront, it's certainly a lightness to it.
I think we are going to move towards audience questions.
Cool.
Now, there's a microphone. There's a microphone over there. For people on the radio, I'm pointing at the microphone. And you can stand up and ask Thomas a question. Oh, there's two microphones. Look, there's one over here, too.
Somebody's got to ask a question.
All right. Do you...
For people on the radio, there's only five people here, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. My mom's in the audience.
Yeah.
Do you get the... now that you're dealing with the responsibilities of managing the multiple establishments, you get the urge to go cook for someone else to see what that's like in somebody else's kitchen?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, the moving into management, it's always, when you're a line cook, you always want to just go in the corner and chop onions. And it's so freeing just to go through, you know, not to be mentally taxed, you know. The hard part about kitchens is that, you know, it's very tough physically. You're around those hot stoves and it's 12-hour, 14-hour days. But it's also very mentally taxing. And when you remove that mentally taxing component of it and you just get to cook, I mean, it's the dream. I literally, and I tell all the cooks, I'm literally working my butt off to one day be a line cook again and have the freedom of being a line cook again. Meaning I can say, well, tonight I'm just going to go cook the line at Central Kitchen. Or tonight I'm going to work the wood oven at Flour and Water and have the freedom to do that. Obviously, with everything going on, it's impossible right now. But hopefully one day everything will kind of settle down and be able to cook again, really.
Yeah. I have this image that chefs, like, who each own restaurants, might gather at the end of service and cook together.
Yeah.
If you had a piece of advice to give to a young chef, a young person who's thinking about it, what would that advice be?
I think it's funny coming from me because it can be perceived that I am very young, but not to move too fast, you know? Not to... the culinary world is a migratory world, and it's very incestuous, right? You go and you work for a year at a place, and then you move on very quickly, and you try to gain this knowledge from a place. If you work for a restaurant in a year, you're not gaining as much knowledge as you possibly can from that. And the more and more that you become comfortable at a place, the more and more that you can actually pick your head up and actually see and actually absorb everything that's going on. And I think that it's very, you know, people want to move around so quickly. They've done a year here in a season, and you know they're sick of the hard work at this restaurant, and then they go on to a next one, and it just never really kind of ends, you know.
And everyone wants to be a network star too.
Sure, yeah.
I think we have a question. There we go.
Hi, my name's Jen. When you cook for a living, does it ever get tedious? Like when you go home and you're hungry, do you order out?
The ongoing joke is that I've lived above Flour and Water for 5 years and I've never cooked a meal in my kitchen. But part of that is because there's a great kitchen downstairs that I can go to. But it does. And I think that...
you ever call down and make them make stir fry for you?
Exactly. Just to mix it up? It's just a pizza, you know, it's a good pizza delivery. What was the book? Eric Repair, A Return from Cooking. What a great book, because he basically said, as a professional, he took some odd time off. I think it's like 4 months or something like that, that he said, you know what, I'm just going to take time off and I'm going to cook. I'll travel the world. I think he went to four places. I haven't read the book in forever. He went to four places in the world and he just cooked. And like I said earlier in the panel, that, you know, that's something different. Just being able to cook is something different than running an operation that cooks. You'd be very surprised how soft my hands are these days, you know. And that's something that as you as we have evolved, there's a lot of things that take you away from cooking, you know? So.
Another question.
Sorry it took a while to ask a question. I've come to 100 of these, and Adam was asking so many good questions. Question for you. How do you know when you're done? I mean, it seems like you know, you're...
It's just not. Hands down, you're just not. If you asked Jacques Pepin if he's done, he would say no. And I would never compare myself. That's not bad because I'm not comparing myself to Jacques Pepin. But you're just not. I mean, there's, like I said, there's so many facets or layers. Put the industry aside. If we're just talking about cooking, put the industry aside. Put a management and PR and, you know, HR and all the things, all the layers that go into a restaurant, put all that aside and we're just talking about cooking, you're never done. You know, look at how many cultures are across the world. I mean, there's certain cultures that, I mean, I'll never get to in my life to ever be able to really like digest and to cook from. And so, that's a tough.
Do you have a favorite cuisine?
You know, it's funny because I was thinking today. I was trying to prepare myself for the interview. And I was thinking today how much I really enjoy eating. Like if I go out, or like I love Thai food. I love Japanese food. And I love eating Asian cultures, and I really don't cook with it. And I think that there's a certain point where young professionals get very confusing and talk about like having a statement with food. And I think I've kind of chosen throughout, maybe, and certainly subconsciously, not to utilize those ingredients in the cooking that I do, because at a certain point it becomes very confusing to me, you know, and actually what it is. I mean, fusion is a tough word to digest, and confusion is pretty close to that, right? You know? And I think that it's just something where I love to eat. I love like the lightness and the freshness of it, and acidity and heat. But it's something that I never really incorporated into the cooking set. You know, so
we have another question over here.
Hey there. I was just wondering what your favorite kitchen gadgets are. I can't live without my Vitamix and like a little Santoku knife.
Okay. Every chef will say it, but plating spoons. I love a great silver spoon.
A plating spoon?
A plating spoon. So a plating spoon, like a silver spoons. Every little chef has a Bain Marie. Bain Marie is like this little metal basin, and you keep your tools in it. It's the tools that you use to plate, and it's maybe a fish spatula that you're gonna flip a fish. It always has hot water. Hopefully that water's clean, and it's always plating spoons. So like silver spoons or whatever it is, but it's what you feel comfortable putting something on a plate, whether that's a vegetable or saucing a dish. And I just have a couple that are like kind of extensions of the hand. They feel so comfortable, and you know, they're old French spoons and they've been with me for a while. So I just lost one, so thanks for bringing it.
Another question.
So the internet says your birthday this week, right? So happy birthday.
Thank you very much.
So my question has to do with, if you were not a chef, what would be your other dream career?
Without a doubt, woodworker. I mean, that is the, and it's the polar opposite, because of the one thing that I struggle with, the most difficult thing about being in a kitchen is that you have to be open at 5:30 every single day, right? There's this immense pressure that goes along with timing, you know? Somebody didn't get the braise started a couple hours late. Somebody burnt the onions, and so we have to start chopping a brand new set of onions too. You have to be open. It doesn't matter what happens. Somebody put all the frog leg soup with all the stuff. You know, you have to be open at 5:30, and so I love working my hands. I love woodworking. I love building things. But I just have this little dream of having a woodworking shop and whittling away with no time, I guess. Yeah.
You know, I've got a woodworking shop in the Mission. You're welcome by any time.
Well, thank you, Adam.
Another question.
Hi, I'm curious about the name of your restaurant group, Natamez. What does it mean? Where does it come from?
So it's my partner, David White's. It's a part of his family crest. And so there's three original partners, myself, David White, and David Steele. And so it evolved. His family crest had three arrows on it. And so we just evolved it that it was the three arrows. And then Natimius means to fear not. I was joking before, not to be confused with the 90s slogan, no fear. It's fear not. But now we've evolved to have six partners total. So Cara Bratcher, who's in the audience. She won't raise her hand, probably. Vanya Shekel, and then Ryan Pano.
We have another question over here on the right.
Hi, my name's Alfredo. Location seems to be one of the key areas for small businesses. What made you choose the Mission District?
It was my partner David Seals' find. He originally found the spot. Where it's at in the Mission, it's like, can you even really call it the Mission? And it's kind of in the Mission and in between Potrero Hill. And I always liken it to Brooklyn, where it was bigger spaces, you know, bigger spaces, cheaper rent, and not that many people were going there at the time. And I think that's really kind of made the key to that success, is that it was cheaper rent, you know, so we could afford to be there. But it was also, there was some kind of draw to go to that area. It's on 20th Street. Yep. And if you are facing Flower and Water, so if you're facing east and you look north, it's all these big warehouses. It's all these huge, huge buildings. And if you look south, it's all these amazing old Victorian homes. And what I didn't really realize, and what we just learned a couple of years ago, is that in the big earthquake, the fire only came to 20th Street. Hmm. So where you see all those big warehouses, the fire swept through and it was all rebuilding, and it was really big industrial buildings and all these old Victorians. And so I think the best part about that location, too, is that it's at the juxtaposition of having industry and then homes. So we have businesses that come, and we also have homes that are so close, and the parking is terrible.
Over here.
Chef, quick question for you. I'd love to know your thoughts on food trucks and street food vendors.
Uh-huh.
Good, bad, ugly?
The amazing thing about food trucks is that it's capital. It doesn't take that much money to put together a food truck. Through new licensing, I mean, red tape and licensing and permits in San Francisco is very, very difficult. It takes a team of people to put together, you know, that, and to go through that process. With a food truck, it's a lot easier, you know, and it's a lot, it takes a hell of a lot less money to get into a food truck. So in that aspect, it's great, you know. Because it takes such little capital and it's a little bit easier, it certainly can be abused, right? And I think that's like you can say the same thing about pop-up restaurants. You know, it doesn't take the capital and the experience and the time and the effort to go through it. We can just pop up. Well, anybody can do it. And then you can go through the layer of it's a great economy in San Francisco right now. And so there's so many people that have access to this capital to open up restaurants that, you know, and I think that it's no different than opening a restaurant. It's no different than doing a pop-up. They're kind of all the same. There's good and there's bad. And there's kind of everything in between.
Over here.
Great, thank you.
I danced around that one again.
Chef,
you did.
Yeah. For those of us afflicted with a gluten allergy, are we
get
doomed?
Out of here. No.
It's not a lifestyle. It's an actual allergy. So, do you have recommendations? Are we, are we doomed to a life of subpar pasta?
No. A couple of things. I love it at Flower and Water when we do vegetable-based plays on dishes. So in wintertime, we'll shave celery root. Really thin and bigger ones that we can fill with a filling, and you can have the same filling that a guest is having next to you, but you have your raviolis made of celery root, you know? And I think that's like a really creative way. I mean, we all know like the spaghetti squash, or you can scrape it, or, you know, I think that's a great one. I think that's really fun. If you're looking for more substance, Cup for Cup is a great product. And I think that's the only product that I've come across on the market that actually works and works really well. You know.
Thank you.
I can attest to it as well.
Yeah.
If you were to to start your career all over again tomorrow, where would you go to learn?
It's so cheesy. I wouldn't change it. I honestly wouldn't. The there's the big debate of culinary school or not culinary school. And I think everyone kind of asked that question. And for me, culinary school is no different than any other school. It's what you put in is what you get out of it, you know. And there's, you know, people that go there and work their butt off and want to absorb as much as they can, work a full-time job, whatever it is, while they're doing it. And they absorb so much and they really take something from it. And then there's people that don't get that much out of it, you know.
Do you give it a lot of weight on a resume?
I don't. I really don't. You know what? Resumes are funny in the industry that we're in because I printed out a resume when I went to Lawfully, and that was in 2002. And I've never printed out a resume since then. And because so much of it was working my ass off and then having somebody wanting to point me in a direction, saying, you know what, for your next step, I think you would do amazing here. And that's what it was. It was going out, and it was understanding the weight of the collaborative nature of the industry and being able to have people help me. It wasn't a resume. You know, a resume gets you a resume that's like 9 pages long, and it's amazing. Wow, this person's worked all over the world, and it's great. And then within 5 minutes in the interview, I'm like, oh, shit, I hope this ends really soon. You know, like, this is painful. And so it's really a give and take. There's two parts of it. You know, if you have the most amazing resume in the world and you're a real jerk to work with, you know, you're going to get sussed out really fast. I mean, you're going to get... And so I think it's a balance of both. There's people with terrible resumes that work for me right now, and they have the biggest hearts in the world, and they give it their all. They'll pull out hot sheet pans from the oven with their bare hands, and all they want to do is learn and push themselves really, really hard. And so you see a little bit of everything, you know. So resume is just one aspect of this job. I mean, it's not that corporate, you know, you need that stamp to then go on to the next level or to have the next job. Please. I don't even know if I'm allowed to do this. Please.
I have a pretty loud voice.
Okay.
It won't be recorded.
Oh, okay. Sure.
So then, in the meantime...
Can we stand up?
Yeah.
I can fill time really quick. Because it piggybacks on your resume thing. I'm curious to go back to your career progression as you've been chatting through the night of the country club to now where you sit today. But when was there like a light bulb moment with the entrepreneurial sort of drive that you had? With like the passion for food and cooking, and you're working at Lawfully, when was it that was like, I got to start a restaurant? And can you walk us through more of that process of just like the idea with it and what struck it, or had you always wanted to own your own business? And
yeah, I think that creative freedom has a lot to do with owning your own business. I think that I'm too much ADD or too much like. You know, wanting to do my own thing to work for another person. I don't mean that in a bad way, like working for the man. But, you know, to be able to, it's the same thing as creating a dish. It's like, I want to think of this idea and I want to do this and I want to implement it. And then when I put that dish up, I'm really proud of it. Well, being your own boss or being an entrepreneur, it's the same thing, just through a different lens. It's like, I have this idea, I want to implement it. And then when I see it being implemented, I'm really happy and I'm proud. And that's what I need to be happy. I have to have some sort of self-worth in something that I'm doing. I can't just like, you know, put in a job, punch the job and go and work and then go home and do something else. It has to be some sort of intermingling and some sense of ownership.
Over here.
Hi.
Back to the microphone.
So there's a lot of food tech happening right now, mm-hmm. you know, especially like chef to like house or not sure the technical mm-hmm. term, but Munchery as an example. So my question is, how critical of a component do you think like the in-house dining is to the overall food experience?
I think it's an amazing thing because you're having access to quality food, if you're buying from the right person, you know, access to quality food that's prepared well, and it tastes great, and it makes people happy. But there's also a component to it that scares me, you know. Everything that's in, it's so funny, like the when people think of the Flour and Water Pasta Cookbook and cooking from it, they're like, oh, it's so labor intensive and it takes so much time and room. I'm like, well, that's what people do in Italy. They think about their meal for hours. They get their family together and you're cleaning the green beans, you're making the orchetti, you know, you're cutting the fish. The part of that food culture hasn't necessarily resonated that much with American culture. I think it has a lot to do with the war. It has a lot to do with innovation through canning, through making things easier, and people working hard. And the basis of it was a great idea, but I think maybe it's a little overflexed right now. You know, but there's a lot of great meals that you can get delivered to your house. Sorry if I offended anybody.
So we are almost done. I want to thank Wells Fargo for being an excellent partner tonight. We have one more question, and it's asked of all the Commonwealth Club guests, which is, what is your 60-second idea to change the world? No pressure.
I know, and I did not practice this one. I forgot about it, too, until they, okay. Can you repeat the question, please?
The city of Antwerp.
Yeah.
What is your 60-second idea to change the world?
60-second idea to change the world. Someone start counting down. If there's any, I think with any sort of change or any, to have any resounding nature to any single idea, A, it takes masses, and A, or B, it takes a common denominator. And if we're talking about a common denominator throughout people, it's food, right? Every single person on this planet has to eat, whether they're sustaining themselves through a vitamin, whatever it is, every single person on this planet has to eat. So if we're looking for a common denominator of change, I got the easy answer, and it's food. And I think it deals with education at an early age that we should understand where our food comes from. And to be able to have it a part of our culture that we understand where our food comes from, so much can come to that. Whether that's buying good food, whether that's not eating too much food, to then the excess food goes somewhere else. Whatever it is, I mean, that common denominator that we all have, that we all have to eat today. We're all going to feel a little bit worse if we didn't eat today. There's a lot of change that can come from that.
Thomas, thank you so much.
How did you walk away?